bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Mr. Brian Breshwood.
It's hot. It's hot, but I'm here. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Or Superman, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody, that's me.
Gentlemen, if I were to ask you what would be the coolest thing you could see, if I said, let's capture an image of one thing, one beautiful thing, what would you want to see? To go viral, to go like, oh my God, this is the thing I wanted to see. I didn't know I needed to see, but now I'm glad I saw it.
I would say a cracked open hole in the middle of the moon that led to a quadruple spiral of crystals, the likes of which humanity had never seen before.
That is strangely specific, Brian.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's not a spiral, what if it's just pointing down?
No deal for Brian. He's like, nope, I've specifically said spiral, no deal. Hold firm.
These ones
on
are like Sarlacc pit teeth, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That'd be all right. But it's like, if I wanted that, I would go to Golden Corral.
Yeah, P.U. No, spiral or none. That's the ask. I would say maybe something underwater, like a full, big, like high-resolution picture of one of these like crazy squids that we ain't never seen.
In a spiral.
Mm.
That's cool.
That's
yeah, spiral. Next to a crystal spiral that fell off the moon and came in and then fell in the ocean.
See, now we're back in business. My money's back out. Good. Bryce, what about you?
You know what I would love just to see a really high resolution would be like of DNA, right? Have we seen DNA? Are you able to just like visualize DNA? I'm assuming we can't. And
well, the way that we use it is there's crystallography was the way we'd use to visualize DNA. And that was sort of like how we're able to figure out what it was, you know, basically using a form of picture taking using crystals or crystallizing it. But there are new forms of optics that are actually, because the problem is it's like the photons that you would bounce off of the individual atoms would be just these waves would be too big to capture. But we do now have ways to perhaps capture that image. So that is a thing that's an area of research actually trying to do that because maybe at some point, Bryce, yes.
Oh, cool. And those are kind of a spiral and all that stuff.
Ah, there's a theme there. I don't have any of that for you. Oh. How about a video though, of a majestic bird flying through the sky?
Ah, birds! I've seen it all the time. And where do they fly? Guess what? 100% always in the sky. So we got a bird that's majestic. Congratulations! That's all birds. Where is it flying? In the sky. Congratulations! That's all birds. There's no way whatever I'm about to see could possibly impress me.
Although, good point. By the way, let's move on to our next story. Yeah.
Smash cut to a penguin on his phone, hashtag not all birds, to Brian's statement that they're flying in the sky.
Wait, what? What is this?
So this was a viral clip. I'm assuming this is the same viral clip that you're leading us to talk about, Andrew.
I'm sure you guys have seen this, right?
Nope.
I have not, no.
Wait. This is a bird that has a fish and is flying around just showing off its fish.
Not quite a fish. Let's take another look at that pass, at that first pass.
Is that a shark?
Is that a bird shark?
So wait, a bird
is that
just
a bark?
Snatched this shark up off the...
The shirt.
Wait, so I have so many questions about this. How big is that
oh
bird?
Oh my God,
how
that is
big
definitely...
is that shark?
Well, first of all, the shark was taken from the shore, so this is a bird shore shark stealing bird shark.
No, cut the video. It's not a spiral crystal on the moon. It's none of these things. It's just, sorry. I'm sorry.
I mean, there is DNA in there.
Yeah.
So wait, what are the details here?
I guess somebody, apparently, again, somebody's at Myrtle Beach with their camera and they happen to see a video in their phone or whatever. And there is a bird. And we don't know if it's a shark or if it's just a fish that's very shark-like. But this bird went in and swooped and picked this thing up. And the shape of the amazing thing, you haven't seen this video, the shape of the fish makes it look like it's much bigger. It looks like one of the, you know, the eagles from Lord of the Rings just swooped in there and picked up like a big shark.
Or one of the eagles from the band The Eagles. Like, they look very big.
Brian, it's not the eagles, it's eagles.
Sorry.
God. Every time. It's hilarious.
That is amazing and creates a very complicated series of thoughts. We were talking about on, I believe it was the Night Attack After Show, about like somebody having a profane statue in their front lawn and the local HOA wanted to take it down. But it's like, what if you made it more profane, but also it was carved out of the living tissue of a tree that took years and years and years to make. So it was, it depicted, let's say, actual sexual congress between Venus and Zeus, but it was a very rare tree. So at what point does your environmentalism trigger overcome your grossness trigger? And
are we launching your new business, Brian Brushwood's Dirty Bonsai now? Is that
let me get a pen. Hold on.
Hold on, wait, Brian's gotta register a web address.
Yep.
Bonsai, B-O-N-B-A-N. I'm sorry.
Dude, that's crazy. So this was just a random I guess so the shark is smaller, so like when you first glance at it, I think you do think of it as like Jaws, and so therefore the bird has to be massive.
Yeah, I feel sorry for, like, imagine somebody's on the beach who's terrified of sharks, and they're like, you know, the mom's like, don't worry, we're not going to go in the water, you're fine, you're safe here.
Yeah.
And looking up and seeing this.
I know, yeah, because now it's like a pilot to bombardier situation. That bird just might get bored and drop a shark hat on someone.
There is a brief moment in this video where it looks like you're looking at a single creature with two heads, you know, like it's about to.
Yeah.
What's the name of that company that launches rockets with a double mast airplane?
Oh, the Paul Allen one?
Yeah.
Strata Launch?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's looks. Yeah. I mean, you know, wonder, like, maybe it was a cooperative thing, you know. The birds flying over. Hey, I can make one of your dreams come true. Really? Yeah. Whoa, this is amazing.
Yeah, I think that's celebratory flailing here in the back half of this video.
turns out nature is just as into the power of the collab as YouTubers are. Anybody see me flying? Yeah. Well, people see me swimming, but you know what they've never seen? And then Rick Smith Jr. shows up and throws cards and hits him or something.
Wait, I think that, like, the fish is swimming along thinking, like, all right, no big sharks in the area. I think today's going to be a good day. I mean, what's the most crazy thing that could happen? And then, you're 500 feet above, you know, the earth flying through the air. Probably very confused. Very confusing.
That shark was, like, this close to retirement.
I'm getting too old for this.
There we go. Flying sharks. Finally, that's what 2020 needed, was flying sharks. So.
Well, look, that might seem out of reach to you, that you in your life would ever in person see a bird pick up a shark and fly through the sky. But you want to know what is within reach? Either your phone or your computer, where you can go to patreon.com/weirdthings and support the show. See, if you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can get your custom RSS feed. You always get the After Things show as soon as possible. You make sure that you support the three of us or four of us getting here each and every week, talking science, talking all the news of the weird for you weekly. patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah, man. Turns out the question between eagle versus shark, the answer is yeah.
Both. Yeah.
Why not both?
Winners all. So there was an announcement today that our Harvard is going to go online only for 2021. Have you seen this?
Yeah. Still $50,000to go to Harvard per year. So, you know, I'll tell you what, that's a pretty expensive Udemy class.
I feel like this is a genie that nobody could put back in the bottle because, like, my kids have already been doing at school or school learning at home. And turns out that outside of, you know, 4 or 5 hours of extra daycare, they only do about 90 minutes of learning. And my eldest daughter, like, already figured that out because she would have 2 to 3 classes per day. They would be one-on-one sessions. And then she would spend 4 to 5 hours just, you know, in the common room getting her work done. And nowadays, I feel like a lot of people are waking up and figuring out, like, yeah, that's about how much school you're really paying for.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, you know, development because, yeah, there's a lot of people that understand, like you do, homeschooling, the value, how to do it. And I have a couple friends who are homeschooled, and they're some of the most capable people I know because, you know, the perception of homeschooled is somebody sitting like in, you know, some kitchen in the middle of nowhere and, you know, being, you know, read from the Bible all day and that's it and no friends. But the homeschooled kids I know are extremely socialized. They have groups. They do all sorts of outings and stuff. You know, I've gone to birthday parties where like way more people showed up there than ever showed up at mine, which may say more about my social skills, but they have spent a lot of time doing stuff. You know, there's a park in Florida where I used to go walking that was pretty close to me. And you have a couple of days a week, a bunch of these homeschool kids would all be there doing activities. And so there's a lot to be said for that and the ability to sort of adapt curriculum and share sort of the responsibilities with other parents. And going beyond that at the college level now, when I mean, yeah, like, you know, is saying anyone, if you say, oh, yeah, I went to Harvard, you know, in 2021 onward or whatever, it's going to be different than saying before because you're not going to have the same interactions with your teacher. A big part of Harvard, the reason you go to Harvard is kind of your friends you make, you know, look at, you know, part of the reason Facebook happened was because of putting these incredibly talented people together in that environment and these things happen. And I think you lose a lot of those aspects of serendipity. And I think, who's to say, you know, somebody doesn't just get some really great teachers and some thinkers and start a completely online school and say, oh, yeah, we've got 10 Nobel laureates. We've got this, whatever.
Justin,
create a new thing.
You and I have thoughts about this.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to go first or you?
Well, you go ahead. I'll back you up.
Well, yes, I understand there's something delightful about being part of a cohort at a time where you're discovering yourself. You're also discovering the thoughts of history's greatest leaders and thought leaders and so on. And it's no accident that folks who date in college tend to be the ones that marry each other, all that stuff, blah, 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 blah. However, when I make a list of all the most successful people I could think of, financially speaking, or even innovation speaking, very rarely do they finish college. And Justin and I were musing around, must have been about 5 years ago, saying like, what would it look like to have a program that gave you the college experience without the college? Because so much of the college experience is dumb. It's dumb that we sort people by their names and then arrange them in miniature clubhouses 2x2. It's dumb that their classes are, you know, rando. And then meanwhile, we look at an Andrew Main who is busy off, you know, sailing the high seas at that exact same moment, learning from the finest minds at the top of their game and learning real life lessons about how to interact and meet with other people that would later lead to the creation of novels and television shows and so much other stuff. I don't know. College, having said all that, I'm thankful for my experience of college, but also college. I don't know.
All right, so where I tend to kind of draw the line here is I don't think that college is good or bad. I think it's unreasonably expensive.
Correct.
And I think that there is a line for which was crossed you know, sometime in the last couple decades where the worth of the diploma itself began to become eclipsed with the student debt that was kind of like hung around the people that were getting it. And the fact that you're not able to, you know, declare bankruptcy on it, blah, 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 blah. What I think Andrew brought up is a fascinating idea of saying like, all right, well, let's understand that an online school cannot do what Harvard can do for you physically. Like, Harvard is a very expensive institution. It's a very exclusive institution. It also is a pathway into tremendous wealth and influence.
It's like a secret code word. Like, you say those words and all of a sudden there's a lot of stuff you don't have to worry about.
I was very, very, when I went to Syracuse, I wound up finding a place where there were a lot of self-starters that, you know, were from decent families that went on to do very interesting and exciting things. If I had not found that niche there, though, I would just have a Syracuse degree, which would, you know, buy me the ability to go into a sports bar and see somebody else in Syracuse gear, and we'd both know the same football references, right? Or basketball references. Harvard is a different animal. Harvard is where you get a lot of people that you can socially connect to. But let's take that away and let's say, all right, maybe you can go to Harvard, maybe you can't. In general, the biggest pre-qualifier to that is that you're from a rich or powerful family, or you are from a family that is sending you to the same preparatory schools where rich and powerful people send their kids or went themselves. If you are to then say, look, maybe we can take an even more star-studded lineup of tele-educators. And maybe to Brian and I's point, what Brian and I thought of, you know, was like, okay, let's also give you a social calendar of things that you should be doing and experiences you should be going on physically, that this could create a more enriching experience. And I think that, you know, you are, I see tremendous a promise in both of what you guys said. Number one, Andrew, the thought, the idea that this could be something that the educators would want to be involved in and could be something that could be a very significant moneymaker. And Brian, you saying that, like, hey, look, the genie's out of the bottle on this. Like, the longer we go with the idea that, like, hey, life is not about, like, let's really shave down exactly what the day's lessons are going to be. Let's pare them down, because it's, you know, we're now out of this idea that, like, well, you're here for an hour, so we're gonna pad this hour however we can, and just get to, like, lesson. Like, I do think that there's going to be a value readjustment in the minds of parents and the minds of kids, and just the ability that we've known for a very long time that all these tools are online. You can go and create whatever you want easier than it's ever been in the history of humankind.
You know, it also opens up the possibility of that you could be a really good professor. And like, I've taken a few online courses and stuff, and I've done stuff like Harvard Extension School and stuff, where, like, when there's like something I'm really curious about and want to learn. And you might take that, and it actually might be a professor of philosophy from Dartmouth who teaches it. You know, they're full, the regular full year they're you know, Dartmouth, but during the summer they do an online course. Well, it's like Harvard. And I think that's kind of neat, is you could have like three, you know, you could be a professor, you could teach at like three different online schools and stuff. I'm excited about the idea, because I could see, like, somebody, a known figure, somebody we respect or somebody like that, saying, hey, we're going to get some of the best teachers, and we're going to create an entirely online thing that's going to be a fraction of a Harvard degree, but we promise you the education quality is going to be better, and we're going to have a really interactive way. Because, like I said, the value of, I look at like a Harvard thing is, one, putting that name Harvard, which opens up doors, but the real value that lasts you the rest of your life is the network you build from, when you're in a really good program with people who are like-minded. And that's the thing I feel like I missed out on, you know, in a very non-traditional path. But, you know, when I, you know, some of my friends though for a long time though were people I had met just taking, you know, random courses and stuff. So, you know, take that away. What do you have? Just a name.
Yeah.
And a big bill.
I'm feeling complicated feelings right now because my eldest, you know, she currently goes to a private academy where she just only meets her teachers, learns the stuff, does her stuff on her own. But her life, her real life, her social life involves a bunch of people I've never met because they're in fan communities and everything is handled online. I asked her once, like, hey, what do your friends say when they find out that I'm your dad? And she looked at me confused, saying, like, they never find out you're my dad. Why would I ever tell anyone you're my dad? And so meanwhile, my middle child, Josie, is very extroverted. You know, she does music classes and they have an awesome program called Band-Aid where, it's not just learning music. You actually have to load in your own equipment, tune your own guitars, set everything up, do the gig, and all the parents show up to be the gig or whatever. But now we're kind of at this place, like she's having such a good time appearing on Scam Nation that it's like, well, maybe she just wants to start doing real open mic nights and doing real gigs as a magician, you know? And youngest is just a wild person. I have no idea what to make of that, but it's hard to know what's the gift and what's the curse, right? Is it a curse that quote unquote real Harvard isn't real Harvard anymore? Or is it a gift that absent real Harvard being real Harvard, anyone could go to Harvard, or it's a lot easier to get a Harvard level degree or not?
The big thing here is that this is all what you make it. Life is what you make it, right? And college is no exception to it. My beef is not that like it is impossible to get what you want out of college. I think it is entirely possible to get what you want out of college. And I got what I wanted out of college, despite the fact that I had tremendous resentment while I was going there that I was spending the kind of money I was to get the product that I was getting. That being said, My big issue is just number one, the myth that you are not complete until you go to college, or that this is the dream that you must fulfill, that it puts upon you some kind of a betterment stamp. Because I know plenty of people that have not gone that have done amazing things, and then I know a bunch of people who went and maybe got some drinking buddies out of it. And then on the other side, it's just, you know, no matter what situation you're in, you have an ability to maximize it. And that's something that, you know, one of Andrew Main's first lessons to me as I was going off to college was like, look at all the equipment they have for you. Look at all the just like raw stuff, like facilities, computers, equipment, like that is there for you. If you are not taking advantage of it, then you are at fault. Like there is no like guided lesson that's going to make you learn, oh wow, that's an opportunity, seize it. And so I think if we're rethinking the future of education, or if we are criticizing the current model for it, I think that these are the lessons that need to be emphasized if we want to make sure that everybody's getting their money's worth.
I think, you know, a thing to sort of follow through is, you know, people pointed out, you know, there's been other online courses. Yeah, distance learning is not a new idea. It's hundreds of years old. What's interesting here is this is the year that Harvard is kind of having its like traditional TV versus YouTube moment, where all of a sudden we're realizing maybe what happens when we compare. You now have to be compared to everybody else offering a product like that. You know, now that you don't have access, a Harvard student doesn't get access to the $800 million whatever library facilities, you know, on campus, doesn't get to use the $100 million rec center. And you take all that away in those buildings with those amazing prestigious names, and it comes down to the quality of the professors, which arguably there's a lot of universities, specifically if you go department to department, there are some departments that are way better in other places, you know, and other places are equivalent. And that's what I'm saying is now is the opportunity for existing or a new thing to say, well, let's create this new era, you know, to create, if a college means sitting in front of a screen and talking to hopefully, you know, a professor, more likely, you know, some TAs and stuff and interacting in a forum. If that's what it means now, who can make the best product? And there's been a lot of, you know, people pointed out like, oh, like there's, you know, MIT courseware, stuff like that. I think the quality there isn't as good as it could be. You know, that the place I go to when I want to learn a topic now is I go to YouTube. The quality of educational material on YouTube, if you know where to look, is fantastic. I learned more about business economics from some 23-year-old kid, you know, in New Brunswick or whatever, creating content, than I do from, you know, somebody who's a Nobel Prize winner who has a course at MIT just because of just the energy and enthusiasm they put into it. And I think one of the things, yeah.
Part of it is the nature of fidelity, where you could watch that 20-minute video on the nature of the wisdom of crowds economics or how prices get set or whatever. And if you get it, you get it and you're done. And you only spent 20 minutes. And if you didn't get it, you're only one click away from somebody else speaking a slightly different language, yes, still English, but using different metaphors, and then maybe after that 20 minutes, you get it. And then, and if you still don't get it, there's yet a third 20-minute video. But the point is, even if you go through all three, you're still taking the same 1 hour that traditionally it would take to eventually get it through your thick head sitting in class while you were, you know, pretending to not check messages.
Yeah. I think that you could find the different ways, but there is this YouTube's competitive, you know, there is this, if I'm not making the best video on how to do this thing, then, you know, I'm going to do my magic video. Well, have you seen Scam School? Ugh, shut up, you know, and you've got that drive, you know, what was good 5 years ago ain't as good as the best stuff now.
Right.
Where, you know, a lot of the college stuff they create is like, you know, I have, you know, a friend whose dad's a professor and, you know, he had to teach his dad how to set up Skype to record his videos. And his dad in person is an amazing teacher. Watching this guy's videos online.
Right.
Not a strength. But
well, and I'm excited. And that's this is like a fairly unchallenged industry that is about to get a rapid, like the horse is about to be out of the barn on a lot of this. And I do think that there will be a rush to set up some kind of like just accreditation might sound, you know, weird, but like when Brian and I had, you know, a night where we were just talking about like what we would do for somebody who didn't want to go to college, because we found ourselves repeating a lot of the same stuff to people that hear us criticize college and say like, okay, well then what should I do? And it's like, all right, well, first off, don't go to college unless you know exactly what you wanted, unless you know how you're going to interact there. Don't think that this is the expensive way that you're going to have your destiny revealed to you. Instead, do these things. And I think if there's a codification for that, now that seems way more like a prudent way to save money or find out who you are, but still enrich yourself than it was initially when Brian and I were talking about it. And it seemed a little bit more like, you know, Fight Club or just like getting in a car and driving as far as you can before you run out of gas. Like, I think that there is now a world as we've like jumped ahead 5 years in 4 months in terms of us being comfortable with tele everything, that now it's like, oh, wait, if I just actually made a commitment and maybe there was some tracking, you know, an app or something like that, some way that you could keep yourself honest. But if it's like, all right, if I'm watching this stuff and I'm showing comprehension and I'm putting it into practice by doing a thing, now this is not like set myself loose into the feral world and hopefully come back with a lesson. It's like, no, this is just smart. Oh, look, you're a self-starter.
Yeah. It's wild seeing, you know, my 16-year-old is already an established member of multiple communities as they do their role-playing, storytelling, whatever. My 12-year-old has already started multiple social accounts as she shares her art stuff. And then also, as a side jag, is showing up as stand-in for a major YouTube channel. And it's like, there came this moment over the weekend where I'm like, what is the moral thing for me to do? Is to say, hey, kiddo, thanks, go back to play? Or is the moral thing to say, you seem to love this, you seem to be good at it, would you like to continue to learn the aspects of production, storytelling, magic, fundamentals? Would the world like to watch your journey over the next 6 years as you start performing gigs and telling your own stories? I don't know. Like, in general, if your goal is to go to college to figure out what you want to do, go to college, figure out what you want to do. But the second, if you're going to college because there's something you want to do, the second you have a chance to go straight to doing the thing that you want to do, go straight to the thing that you want to do.
Yeah. I will say this, my final thought is, we've all been to other countries where people don't have the advantages we have here, you know, and there are parts of our country where, you know, advantages aren't, you know, places where things like a college education or a good college seem very almost impossible to do that. When you can take all the ridiculous costs out of that, the administrative overhead, the ridiculous buildings, things like that, and focus on teachers and students and those things, it is exciting, because I think about, you know, some person in a lesser developed country, the reality they could get a quality degree through distance learning without having to have the family bankrupt, you know, with loans and stuff. We get a lot of students who come overseas to come to the schools in the United States. They're all middle and upper class. You know, poor people from other countries don't get access the way, you know, other people do. And that's one of the things, is like I've said, like, you know, people talk, one of the things when you look at like income distributions by like nationality and stuff, the thing I point out is like, you have to remember that part of that has to do with self-selecting, because, oh, we only let the rich people from this country come here, and they're going to come here and they're going to do really well. We don't do enough to increase the opportunities for people who are even more hard work or determined, who are at the bottom. But, you know, that's what excites me, is just, oh man, you know, the idea of, you know, really, really making this kind of education universally available, accessible to just everybody. I mean, think of all the brilliant people out there waiting to happen, you know, with this, the new discoveries, the new things, when these things go, you know, more global. So I'm excited.
Got him again.
100%.
Take that, college.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Double your fees again? Come at me, bro.
Yeah. Oh, God. I saw an article in my news feed today, because I follow stuff dealing with artificial intelligence. And apparently there is a new project that allows you to write to famous people or historical people and have simulated conversations via email.
Oh, my gosh. And it sounds amazing.
This is such a ripoff. A buddy of mine did a project like this. and so I don't even know what to say.
I don't know. Maybe dangerous territory here.
It might be. No, we're being silly, because this is a project that Andrew created as part of his work with the OpenAI API. And it is extraordinary. Andrew, do you want to just lay out what it does?
Yeah. So this was, the Next Web did a nice little write up from it. And if you go to aiwriter.app, there's more info on it. I've been playing around with OpenAI's API, which is a way to use, OpenAI works on artificial intelligence technology, and they're trying to find ways to make it more accessible, because when you're working with, let's say, a large neural network that's able to do stuff like text generate, like generate passages of text and try to figure out what you're sending to it, maybe to correct, you know, physical addresses and properly straighten them, or to write summarizations of large text into smaller amounts. And again, there's a lot of applications for it. The problem is that those models that do it are huge. They can take up several gigabytes, 35 gigabytes, I think, in the case of like one of the larger ones that's out there, which is not practical for most users. So OpenAI created this API, meaning you just take a little bit of code, a little password, and you say, here's some text, figure it out, and it sends something back to you. And the API has consumed large amounts of the internet, and it understands, as we talked about on a previous show, it knows who Brian is, who knows who Justin is. It's able to kind of recreate kind of parody versions of, you know, Night Attack. It can also write, you know, compelling, for a period of a few paragraphs at least, fan fiction, et cetera, and has a lot of other potentials. One of the things I decided to experiment with was the ability for it to mimic historical figures. Could I write a letter to Mark Twain and ask him a question and get a Mark Twain response back? Could I do that with Richard Nixon? And I found out that I was getting incredibly realistic responses back most of the time. And so for fun, I built an app where you just write to an email address, and I'll be making this more available soon. If you write to an email address, you will get a response back from that person. And so I have some examples there. I don't know, Bryce, if you want to take a look at some of those.
I'm reading your letter to Benjamin Franklin, in which Andrew opens by saying, "Dear Benjamin Franklin, how would you compare 21st century social media to the news and industry of the 18th century? Warmly, Andrew Main." Dear Andrew, they are both forms of media that seek to promote content that will interest their audience. In both instances, they'll offer each other people a chance to become something bigger than themselves, to be part of a community with shared interests. This is not unlike other forms of media, literature, for example. And like the publishing industry and social media, it's hard to discover the value of some content. A screed against George Washington one day, followed by a raving endorsement of him the next, are both from the same source? Is the author rational? Is the content fact-based? A thoughtful post is only a click away from the ravings of someone who has watched too much television. But in both cases, it takes time to discover the difference. And in both social media, or in both media and social media, those who are shouting are often the ones who get hurt. Warmly, Benjamin Franklin.
As I know, it's authentic.
It's so good. It's so good.
There, when Andrew was first working on this, he was just texting me stuff he would get back from Richard Nixon. And obviously with Raise the Dead, I've done a lot of research into Richard Nixon. And I feel like I have a genuine idea of how he would answer certain questions. And it was eerie. Like it was so dead on, down to the way that Nixon would acknowledge certain things, but always want to come off as a bigger man. And I think that was the biggest thing that's amazing about this is that it gets at least enough of what we would imagine the personality to be of some of these people by way of making us understand this is how they would write to a stranger. Like this is them taking the time out of their day to write to someone they don't know. And the framework to that, I think, is just that's what takes it the extra mile, because it just gives you the human idea of like, oh, well, how Nixon would respond to me if I were his best friend, if I had talked to him every day. But I do know how they might write to me if I were just a fan asking him a question.
This and you feel that in this exchange. Dear Hulk, why Hulk smash? Best Banner. Dear Bruce, Hulk likes to smash. Why? Hulk not know why. Please help. Your friend, Hulk.
That was my favorite one. I'm like, I'm late at night. I've been testing everybody, and I'll tell you the where it went awry. I'm gonna write to Hulk. Dear Hulk, why Hulk smash? And then I'm reading this, Hulk not know why. Please help. I'm like, oh my God, poor Hulk. And that's the scary part, because you will get compelling responses back from people. And I need to do, I'll probably elaborate and say how good will these be. I'm like, the more the internet knows about this person, the better they will be, or the more this topic is discussed, the more variety you will get.
I also like the the fact that the responses oftentimes adopt the socially distant tone that you would expect, the professional tone. For example, this letter: Dear Bruce Wayne, I was wondering if you would sign our petition and make a contribution to our organization, which is dedicated to proving the innocence of the Joker. Regards, Andrew Main, Free the Joker. Andrew. I appreciate the hard work and concerns about your friend the Joker. However, I am afraid I have to decline your petition. Sincerely, Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. So you can do things like, and I'll probably go a little bit more into it, like some people do are, if that person's, like, there is a famous director who's well-respected, who's known for being kind of brusque and stuff. And if you ask him, hey, can I get some advice? He'll basically tell you to F off. But if you're like, hey, thank you so much for agreeing to work with me on my project and letting me know that I could write you and ask you questions, how would I do this? So if you manipulate the AI by basically saying, we're friends, oh, I'm your cousin so-and-so, whatever, you will get a response like that. They will respond to you that. And you can write to people. Like, if I want Isaac Asimov to, like, finish something for me, he won't. But if I write to him as Arthur C. Clarke, a little more, you know, willing to do that, because it knows who Arthur C. Clarke is, too. And if there's stuff, it's amazing. It's amazing to see how adaptive the API really is at all that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I got Tom Meritus texting me. Apparently he says this was going to be a topic on DTNS before he realized that I was the one who made it.
No, he won't.
No, you're like, screw this. No. So anyhow, AIwriter.app, check it out. I'm going to be, we'll see. Right now it's an experiment. We're rolling out. We got to make sure this is used safely and appropriately. You know, I'm trying to put filters in place. I don't want everybody, like, trying to write to Hitler. You know, I don't, you know, tell me more of your ideas. No, don't. Please, don't.
Please, no.
Yeah. I tried to build in an obscenity filter, and then I'm like, well, let me test it with, you know, metaphors and analogies and stuff. And then so I took a bunch of stuff from, like, Harry Potter fan fiction, like slash fiction and stuff. And it basically just broke my filter because apparently, like, you know, a magic wand in any other context would seem pretty normal, you know? Like, who would suspect?
I mean, all of a sudden it turns into AI Cummings, am I right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good. Come check out my cauldron. I think this is...
All right. Oh, come on. AI Cummings, that was pretty good.
I know. It was great. I was leaving it breathe. It was. That was it. That was the line.
Yeah. So... anyhow, thanks for letting me talk about that. I'm very, very excited and more to talk about. I've been kind of doing these periodic projects, working on different stuff. This was a project from last weekend. Had a conversation with somebody on Saturday, and I'm like, oh, it'd be neat to make this more accessible to other people, because I want other people to, my goal is to make these tools available to as wide a number of people as possible. I don't want AI just to be a thing of a few corporations or some people who have some, you know, background in machine learning. I want everybody to have access to it and do that. And then it's fun to see this. So there we go. Gentlemen, do you have any picks?
Yeah, I watched Terminator and Terminator 2, which I didn't think I would watch the first one, because all I wanted to see was the second one. Justin made a really good point of, like, hey, your kids will never grow up in the universe where either one lived in a vacuum. The chance for them to see, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is the only, I believe, AFI top 100 both villain and hero for the same character, like, let's go for it. So we went through the original Terminator. It hung in there, I guess. But Terminator 2, man, it was so much fun to watch my 12-year-old, because my 16-year-old, like, she knew the conceits of both movies. But the 12-year-old, to have her be genuinely confused for the first 20 minutes of that movie as to who is the good guy and who is the bad guy, and then have that resolved when you're like, oh my God, he's the good guy this time. So much fun. Highly recommend it. If you have the means, deceive your children.
I love the first one, because, like, that movie, it was independently financed. And you look, the budget it was made for, and it was, you know, Cameron fought to be able to make that movie, because at that point, you know, he was a guy that did some VFX for Corman movies, and he was known as kind of an up-and-coming screenwriter. And, you know, there's the story of how he was asked to write, like, Rambo 2 and Aliens at the same time. And, you know, Terminator was in the process of being made, but he wanted to direct Aliens. And they're like, no, we're looking for a different quality director, whatever. And then Terminator came out, was a huge hit. They're like, oh, you know, it'd be great for directing Aliens. Your script that you wrote for us would be you. And, but you look at Terminator for the budget was made for, what he pulled off. I mean, way punching above its weight. Really. It's, you know, it's my girlfriend, you know, she was born after that movie. It's one of her favorite movies of all time.
Total mind blow watching, because it had been a good, like 20 years since I'd seen it. But, the forensic psychologist, the cop, head doctor, discovering, yeah. realizing that that's the same one who has now made a career on Sarah Connor in T2 was awesome.
Oh yeah. Oh, it is the follow-up, it did a wonderful T1 to T2 is great. It's like Batman Begins to Dark Knight. We set up this great universe in the first one. And the second one, let's pick up the pieces. Let's really think of where things lay and it can't lie. And it's like Empire Strikes Back. It's just this really, we can go bigger. We don't have to repeat. There is this sort of repetition of sort of a similar thing, but let's change it up. But I like the first one, like that's the police station. You're in a police station. You're safe. Everything's fine.
Oh, hey, everything's cool. Except not so much, Al. So the question, Justin, is, do I do the same trick with Alien and Aliens, or am I allowed to go straight to Aliens?
Both.
No. Yeah. I mean, because both, the reason this came up was because you were showing your 16-year-old daughter something that she was like very frustrated with, the very feminine heroine, right? Or a very prissy female, very girly female character. And so Terminator came up and Aliens, because it's like, well, if the two most like iconic badass women characters are Sarah Connor and Ripley, and you kind of got to see where they come from to appreciate that journey. That's why you had to watch Terminator before you see her in Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think similarly, you won't quite appreciate, not that Ripley's a shrinking violet in Alien, but like to see her as badass war commando, I think you need to appreciate that first movie.
She's also, I don't think they even hint that she's secretly the protagonist until almost halfway through that movie. Like they yeah, give absolutely. You a long time to think she's just another one of the crew.
It's one of the brilliant things about it is that you don't know, and as she, but you see her strengths come forward, and you know part of the reason why that character was originally written for a man.
No kidding. Yeah.
And then hey, why don't we change this to a woman? And I think that was wonderful thinking, was because that, you know, the kind of overcame the writer's bias of like, oh, I know how to write normal people, and then I know how to write women, which is a very bad way to think about things.
Right.
And to say like, let's put a person into a difficult situation, blah, 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 blah. And then, oh yeah, woman, you know, and I think that's part of what made it so wonderful and why I think that really was a breakthrough role, breakthrough character in movies, you know, and I think that a lot of female characters, the really good ones, have stemmed from, you know, Ellen Ripley and Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
So cool. Any other picks?
Yeah. So I've talked a little bit about You Must Remember This, the podcast, history podcast about Hollywood history. And I had heard whenever I brought it up, that there was probably the most famous season that had been made of this was a 12-part series on Charlie Manson's Hollywood. And I am now, I think, 9 episodes into it. And I wonder where either it might just be parallel sensibilities, but I wonder if this was something that came across Tarantino's world as he was writing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because whether or not they had anything to do with each other's creation, it is an excellent companion piece to understanding a lot of what Tarantino was saying about that moment in time, specifically where Hollywood was in the late 60s, where show business was in the late 60s, the fact that there was this specifically this creaking element of the free love hippie movement that was souring. And that's where Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood got criticized, was like, oh, well, why is this movie so anti-hippie? And it's like, you know, all the protagonists are these, like, you know, straights, and they're, you know, criticizing this movement. And yeah, I mean, the Manson family was the worst elements of it, but there is a larger context to it that I was able to, even I haven't rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yet, having finished this, but I'm excited to, because I think that there's a lot to be said about, like, what that hippie movement was, where it interacted with the crumbling form of Hollywood at the time, and more specifically, you know, what a and this is where I think there was a lot of a similarity between these two works, just what a fascinating character Sharon Tate was, and how she was you know, had her life cut short, obviously tragically, but understanding even the fuller context of Sharon Tate in this podcast series makes you just even all the more appreciative that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood makes the creative decisions that it makes by the end of that movie, because you recognize even more so, it's even an even richer appreciation that you know, life is unfair and it would be nice if things didn't happen that way.
Yeah. I really want to check that, because it is that, you know, we take a thing and we judge it for where it started, which was, you know, the idea of kind of a lot of, you know, the hippie movement had a lot of these great values about trying to move things forward. And then the sociopaths showed up, and, you know, another thing that gets forgot is for Jim Jones, the People's Temple came out of that. You know, he was actually, you know, a Marxist who said, hey, how do I get people on board with this stuff? And he had the support of a lot of people in California. He moved to San Francisco. It's like, you know, you had, you know, like Jane Fonda and other people like, oh, you're doing great work and stuff, because he was seen of that movement. And then, you know, a trip to another country, 900 people dead later, we're like, no, that's something different. I'm like, well, you know, you never know who's going to show up at your party.
And that's the thing, is what I did not appreciate, because I have not read a lot about the Manson murders aside from kind of surface level stuff, is just realizing, especially in San Francisco and in LA, there were just these areas that was almost like a job fair for gurus. Like, lost people would just show up, and you just listen to these, the idea of just like, yeah, I don't know, am I God? You want to listen to me talk? Like, you want to experience these drug-fueled journeys? Like, well, then come on. And some are more about the drugs, and some are more about the sex, and some are more about the religion. But you would just kind of mall sample court all these gurus, and then you would find one that you would follow. But the idea that people would leave each other for other gurus, like, was very, very common. And then Charlie Manson, as he kind of comes up as a career criminal and somebody that idolized pimps and was fascinated by how to win friends and influence people, and some of the Scientology teachings, like the game became for him and many of these other gurus retention, people retention.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. And this is where things start to get into these very, very dark places. But you know, it's obviously, compared to some of Carina Longworth's later stuff, it's a little bit less polished. But the research is obviously there. And I think her greatest, her power pitch is really breaking down some of the labyrinthian business elements of Hollywood, and specifically who's married to who is friends with who, how do things get done? And there's a lot of great stuff there, specifically around Charlie Manson's push to become a superstar musician
in an alternate universe.
Well, I mean, apparently it's like he had met, like, the the reason why he didn't become a musician was because he couldn't handle himself recording. He had multiple opportunities to record demos with like people that would have names who's carried that would have sheltered him through, but multiple times he gets in a recording studio, multiple times it ends up with him pulling a knife on the recording op because they're trying to tell him how to speak into a microphone correctly.
Oh, yeah. Let me get a knife. Sorry, Bryce, you were saying what?
I do have a pick, but I just finished, so I do the Friday night video game streams here on Twitch, and we just finished up a relatively new game. I guess it's been out for maybe a couple years now, called Life is Strange 2. This is a different story, but it's kind of in the same sort of vein as the original. It's really a shame that that this game did not get as much conversation about it versus the first game. You know, the Life is Strange one is you play like a high school girl who gets time travel powers when her friend gets shot in front of her. Now the apocalypse is happening. Guess what? You're using these powers and nature is revolting. And at the end of that, spoiler alert for this 5-year-old game, you either get to save the town and your friend dies, or the town is destroyed and you two live. And it's set in this like five, it's an episodic game. So like, as you go through the pieces, you make choices and people will remember this and all. But at the end of the day, you just make that choice at the end of the game. And what was really, really eye-opening, especially in this last episode of Life is Strange 2, is that you are making choices along the way because it's your little brother who has a superpower. And so you are not only making your own decisions on how to travel across the country with him, but also like how to raise him because he's like 10 years old. And so that factors into the end of the game. So it's not just what do you decide, but also what about the results of your brother who you tried to raise? What type of person is he? And that affects the ending. You kind of have a small matrix of endings. And it's really like, a story of the times, right? Like the initial conflict is that your father gets shot, by the police, and he's completely innocent. That you are two kind of Latino brothers who are making their way down to Mexico, and there's all sorts of really good stuff in there. And it's just such a shame because the first game got a lot of attention for being like, oh, isn't this bad adults writing teen dialogue stuff? But I think this is really sweet and a really gripping story. If you've got, it's also like relatively, each episode's only like three and a half hours long. So if you've got a little bit of time, it's a really great story in Life is Strange 2.
Nice.
Yeah. Andrew?
My pick is I don't want to, I wasn't very satisfied. I'll put it this way. Okay. Westworld season 3. What I would say, the music's great and some of the production values were really, really cool. Really, really cool.
Actors were good.
So the actors are great, great cast.
Great scenes, great set design.
Scenes. And I've never made a TV show like this. I've never done that. I've never worked on a network to do narrative content. I do not know. And I know I've gone to the first part of that, and I've seen where, oh, we want it to be this, or we want it to be that, and we want it to be this. And I think that what I loved about Westworld, season 1, which I was very mixed about, though, was there were neat themes. There were some really intelligent observations on stuff. And then sometimes it just felt like a show that wasn't an HBO show. And season 3, I felt like it wasn't sure where it wanted to, like, you're following a plot lines for two characters that really have nothing to do with the events of that literally, like, they're trying to set for season 4. And maybe I don't get it. And I'll probably go back. And my appreciation for season 1 went up when I watched it again and sort of made allowances for that. But I would say I love the music, and I don't mean that lightly. I think that like there is some of the quality of some of the stuff that's going in right now. Like I'm watching Watchmen right now, And the scoring is wonderful. I mean, wonderful. And I think that's one of the things I guess I'm going to talk
agreed.
About.
Agreed. Wholeheartedly agreed. Watchmen's Westworld season three. Music. Awesome.
Westworld season three soundtrack. That is my pick.
Westworld season three is so bizarre because, and we talked a lot about this because we slow motion ran through it week after week. And it's like somehow season three manages to be less than the sum of all of its parts, because every single thing you could point to, I could say that was amazing. All of the acting, amazing. Most of the writing, amazing. All of the set pieces, amazing. Special effects, amazing. The scale of the world, amazing. All of those things, amazing. The bravery to step outside of the narrative that was in season one and season two, also brave and amazing. And yet somehow, after all of that, every single week, it was like, all right, let's just do it again.
My thing was like, I loved they went around the world to show, like they went to places like Dubai and like Singapore and stuff to show like the future, because there are these we have futuristic cities today. And I really liked that. Okay. My confusion, I'll just put it that, was like, you know, Aaron Paul, I think, is a great actor, but this is a character. When we're introduced to him, you know what his big reveal is. You know the world you're in the first episode. You know the thing, and you're like, man, we got seven episodes in, and you're telling us this is the truth of it. Like, we've seen enough Black Mirror, we've seen enough stuff, we know the language of this to know where this is. And it's also like, we didn't get enough of like, it's this dystopian world where, one, it looks pretty awesome. Other than, you know, people are playing a real life version of Grand Theft Auto, it's like the cities are, they're showing LA. I'm like, man, the homeless people, they've got jobs and stuff now or whatever. Like, man, this looks clean. I want to live in this LA as opposed to the LA I'm in right now. And so yeah, that was like, you know, it's the Phantom Menace problem. Like, oh, save my people. We never met them. We don't know who they are.
During, you know, that moment of unrest, the episodes of unrest, I guess, in the back half of that, like, other than very specific riot scenes, there's not like pedestrians or anyone walking their dog or nothing.
Somebody picked up like three copies of the LA Times and just sort of threw them up in the air and said, chaos. And walked off like that PA got fired later that day.
Yeah, I felt like that there are, it had, and again, the themes it wanted to deal with, I loved, because, you know, it's this, you know, spoiler alert, it's the idea of, you know, using some big powerful algorithm to determine the fate of everybody, which, you know, I call it China as told in the, you know, LA in Westworld. And I think that's a very good topic. And I love to see that sci-fi has sort of moved on and caught on to ideas about the simulation, you know, AI and stuff. I like that. I like that we're getting more intelligent sort of observations on this stuff now. So I would say if you made it through season two, watch it. Maybe season four, you know, it'll go somewhere kind of cool, because they certainly felt like they were setting stuff up in season three, because there are two storylines in there that do nothing to resolve the conflict of season three.
It does look like at the very end of season three, they set up sort of there's going to be a big leap to whatever's next. Over time. So,
yeah. Like, the cast is great. It's a great cast, and I think I like. It's always like, I like everybody involved. And it's hard. I don't want to be like, what's that?
Have you watched Devs yet?
He loved Devs.
We've talked about Devs. All right, we did. Okay, I can't remember. I remember.
I was texting you about Devs.
Yes,
I was like, you gotta watch.
It's hard to remember because
I'm the one who hasn't watched.
Right, Justin hasn't watched it.
He's the one who
he's convinced that
it.
Bryce hates it. I love it.
Because he does. And he hates it.
Yeah. And it's because of your recommendation.
Devs is my favorite. Let's talk about what this the
that's not what I heard Bryce say, though.
All right.
I heard Bryce say the opposite.
Put a pin in that.
Did he made that podcast a daily? Was really weird.
Yeah, that's just weird, man.
Save it for the many worlds where we have more time, which is not this one.
Bryce hates Devs.
My second favorite thing of new content about the future is Upload. I think that, you know, doing it in sort of let's look at this from a slightly askew, kind of absurd way. I really like Upload.
Right. Yeah. On. Upload is light. It's goofy. Yeah. But
better than Space Force.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Because
Upload knows what it's trying to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Upload, the characters are real. And Upload, it's real characters in a crazy sort of future. Right. They act like normal people for the most part. Where Space Force, I'm going to be wacky this scene. No, I'm going to be serious. No, I'm wacky. And you're like, I don't know. Like, you're supposed to be an idiot. Now you're teaching your daughter trigonometry. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Very, very mixed message out of Space Force. I just finished that this weekend. Ugh.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyhow. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.